A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Welcome to the History of the Saints podcast. My name is Glenn Rawson, series host. What you are about to listen to is an episode about the documentary history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This episode is one of more than 250 presentations from 1805 and the birth of Joseph Smith the prophet through 1877 and the death of Brigham Young. This series interviews some of the finest scholars of our time and presents the latest in historical research and facts as it relates to early Latter-day Saint history. And it comes from the long-running, highly acclaimed television documentary series, History of the Saints. If you have a desire to learn the history in depth and detail, then this podcast is for you. Thank you for joining us.
The Smith family were crucial in the translation of the Book of Mormon. The Hale family, the Whitmers, all of these families welcomed Joseph Smith into their home and allowed them, for a time, a space to translate the Book of Mormon. When we look at the Book of Mormon and the production, the translation of the Book of Mormon, it really is, on one end, a community effort, a community production. Joseph Smith could not have devoted as much time as he could have without that support.
Joseph Smith Jr. and Oliver Cowdery began the work of translating the gold plates together on Tuesday, April 7th, 1829. They began their work in what is today Mosiah Chapter 1. From then until about June 1st, they labored there at Joseph and Emma's small farm home in Harmony, Pennsylvania. The work they were doing was important. But consider, they still had a farm to tend to at this spring season, and they still needed to put food on the table.
In 1829, Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith had need. They couldn't continue the translating, so they asked for help from the Knight family.
Now Joseph and Oliver came up to see me. If I could help him to some provisions, they having no way to buy any. I bought a barrel of mackerel and some lined paper for writing. And when I came home, I bought some 9 or 10 bushels of grain, and 5 or 6 bushels of taters, and a pound of tea, and I went down to see him, and they were in want. Joseph and Oliver were gone to see if they could find a place to work for provisions, but found none. They returned home and found me there with provisions, and they were glad, for they were out. Then they went to work and had provisions enough to last till the translation was done. Joseph Knight, Sr.
Joseph Smith makes mention of this generosity of the Knight family in his history, makes a point of it. And he said, for example, he several times afterwards brought us supplies, a distance of at least 30 miles, which enabled us to continue the work, when otherwise we must have relinquished it for a season. About that time, while Oliver Cowdery and Joseph were translating, Father Knight asked Joseph what he should do to help the work. And we have a revelation to Father Knight. Joseph Smith wrote down, and he basically said, there is a marvelous work to come forth. Help bring the work forward. And he also said, the field is white, ready to harvest, as was said in many of those early revelations. Well, guess what? What field was ready to harvest better than the Knight and Peck family? As we see, within a year, we have so many converts that form this Colesville branch.
At first,
There may have been relative peace for Joseph while translating there in harmony, but as time went on and the word got out, the spirit of persecution began to intensify, particularly among some of Emma's family members.
There's just no evidence to how that persecution played out, other than that we know that some of Emma's family members played a role. Emma's brothers would yell in the house while Joseph was trying to translate, and there was a little scuffle with family members as they continued to say things to Joseph. There seems to be that sense of, as long as Joseph's working on the translation, Emma's family just can't quite respect him as an individual because he's not doing the kinds of things that they see a respectable young man would do. He's not out trying to make his way in the business world. He's not out making quick payments on the land that he ought to be owning, and so on. And so, to that extent, I recognize that the family may have felt somewhat justified in the way they treated Joseph and their perspective about him. But certainly, a lot of their feelings also had to do with religion and with the things that Joseph was teaching, and particularly Emma's uncle, Nathaniel Lewis, who had been first ordained a deacon in the Methodist Church and later possibly also ordained an elder in the church. Nathaniel Lewis had negative feelings toward Joseph, continued to challenge him on things like translation.
Their intentions of mobbing us were only counteracted by the influence of my wife's father's family, who had become very friendly to me, and who were opposed to mobs and were willing that I should be allowed to continue the work of translation without interruption, and therefore offered and promised us protection from all unlawful proceedings. Joseph Smith.
Evidently, while Isaac Hale didn't particularly like Joseph nor believe in what he was doing, he disliked mobs even more, and he protected Joseph. But it reached a point when the spirit of persecution became too much. It was revealed to Joseph that evil, designing people were seeking his life in order to prevent the work of God. Joseph asked Oliver to write to David Whitmer for help. The Whitmer family of Fayette, New York, believed in what Joseph was doing. They were welcoming and curious. However, before David could leave, there was work on the farm to be done at the spring season. The next day, accordingly, David went out to plow and found that 5 to 7 acres of his ground had been plowed during the night, and the plow left standing in the furrow right where he would have left it. Then David was able to accomplish planting in one day what normally would have taken him 2 days. The family took note of this. Then David went out to spread some fertilizer. The fertilizer was gone. He was informed that 3 mysterious strangers had come on the field and spread the fertilizer with amazing rapidity. Well, that was miracles enough for the Whitmer family, and David went to Harmony. It was on the return trip back to Fayette when David recorded this event as happening.
A very pleasant, nice-looking old man suddenly appeared by the side of our wagon and saluted us with a, "Good morning, it is very warm," at the same time wiping his face or forehead with his hand. We returned the salutation, and by a sign from Joseph, I invited him to ride if he was going our way. But he said pleasantly, "No, I am going to Cumorah." This name was something new to me. I did not know what Cumorah meant. We all gazed at him and at each other, and I looked around inquiringly of Joseph. The old man instantly disappeared. It was the messenger who had the plates, who had taken them from Joseph just prior to our starting from Harmony. David Whitmer.
And so they head up to Fayette. Probably, you know, about the time, it was end of May, first of June, where they head up to Fayette, move in with the Whitmers. And so you've got the Whitmers helping out for that last month or so.
Upon our arrival, we found Mr. Whitmer's family very anxious concerning the work and very friendly towards ourselves. They continued so and boarded and lodged us according to proposal. And John Whitmer, in particular, assisted us very much in writing during the remainder of the work. Joseph Smith.
Mother Mary Whitmer already had a large family and a large household to care for, and now with the addition of Joseph and Oliver at first and Emma later, well, that was 3 more adults to care for. That significantly increased her burden.
Joseph and Oliver took a break and went out and were throwing rocks in the pond. And here is poor Sister Whitmer doing all these household chores and everything, and she's sitting there sort of grating at all of this and saying, look, if they want to spend their energy doing something, I got work they can do. And according to this account, she was going to turn them out. And she was in and out milking, and she's coming from it, and this is when the angel appears to her.
She was met out near the yard by the same old man who said to her, you have been very faithful and diligent in your labors, but you are tired because of the increase of your toil. It is proper, therefore, that you should receive a witness that your faith may be strengthened. Thereupon, he showed her the plates. David Whitmer.
19-year-old Sally Heller Conrad was working as a housekeeper for the Whitmers at this time. She noticed these young men coming down from upstairs to take a break with a strange glow about their countenance. It frightened her, but no one would tell her what was going on up there. Finally, Sally threatened to quit if she wasn't informed, so the family told her of the sacred work that was being done. On April 6th, 1830, at the organization of the church, Sally was there. She died in 1903 in Provo, Utah, a faithful member of the church.
A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Though we don't know exactly how the translation process worked, what we do know is that it was difficult, particularly for Joseph and for the scribes.
When Oliver Cowdery does try to translate, we get some hints there in section 9 that one of the reasons he was given the opportunity to translate seems to have been to give Joseph a break. Just because it was taxing on him to be that focused, kind of took it out of him. And when Oliver failed, you know, the Lord says, don't worry about it, we're going to be okay. Don't you see that I've given Joseph additional strength to make up for it? But that little phrase hints at just how tiring the translation itself was. And so with the translation being a full-time exhausting job, and then writing, I mean, if you've ever written for more than a half of an hour, you know how tiring that can be.
Most of the time they're doing okay, you know, but there are going to be these moments they're going to get tired. And we have in the copying process, when Oliver's main copying, he'll do fairly fine. Then all of a sudden, within a few lines, he'll make 6 changes, 5 of them accidental, just boom, 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 boom. This is a sign you're falling asleep.
It was a laborious work, for the weather was very warm, and the days were long, and they worked from morning till night. David Whitmer.
For Joseph, however, it went beyond tedium. It was spiritually taxing work. At all times, Joseph had to live in and be worthy of the Holy Ghost in order to translate.
David is there, and he tells of a time where Emma had done something that had irritated Joseph, and he kind of snapped at him. And they shortly after try to translate, and nothing comes.
He could not translate a single syllable. He went downstairs, out into the orchard, and made supplication to the Lord. was gone about an hour, came back to the house and asked Emma's forgiveness, and then came upstairs where we were, and then the translation went on all right. He could do nothing save he was humble and faithful. David Whitmer.
This is a revelatory experience, and revelation is something that you earn, you qualify for, and your heart and your mind, they have to be in the right place. You have to be living well to receive revelation, and even then it's hard. And here was a three-month period where Joseph had to be living really, really well and treating people nicely and living very humbly with an attitude of repentance and an attitude of forgiveness. And again, at the end of it, not only do we have the Book of Mormon, but we have a refined prophet, someone who's been living on a very high level of spirituality in order to get this book to come forth. And he's a better person because of the process.
Sometime in June of 1829, Joseph and Oliver reached the end of Mormon's abridgment of the large plates of Nephi, or as we know it now, Moroni chapter 10. Then by the Lord's command, they went back and began the translation of the small plates of Nephi, or in other words, 1 Nephi 1.
One thing that they did that we now are pretty sure of was that when Joseph Smith lost the 116 pages, he was in Mosiah. When Oliver came, they continued from Mosiah and through Alma all the way to end of Moroni, and then did the small plates. And the small plates seem to have been done in the Whitmer home near the end.
June 11, 1829. As the completion of the translation of the Book of Mormon drew near, Joseph felt the need to secure the copyright of the Book of Mormon.
On June 11th, they filed an application according to the laws of the state of New York. If they wanted to own property, or if they wanted to conduct marriages, or if they wanted to register as a church, then they had to observe an April 5th, 1813 law, which dealt with the incorporation of religious societies. And more on that, but they wanted to file a copyright on the Book of Mormon to make sure that no one else interfered with the work. And so on that day, the 11th of June, with Richard R. Lansing, who lived in Utica, New York, he was the clerk of the Northern District Courts and the person with whom you filed a copyright. And so that was arranged, whether by mail or in person. It was filed, and the copyright was later registered in Washington, D.C.
The Book of Mormon has been called a marvelous work and a wonder. Part of what has caused people to marvel and to wonder is how could a book such as that come from a lad like Joseph?
When we say Joseph Smith had 2 years of education, this means two winters. They worked right into the fall, get through the harvest. Then when they had some time, they went to school. But when spring came, early spring, they're out there working again. The notion that Joseph Smith has 2 or 3 years of education is not what we would have. You know, they're not starting September 1st and going to June 1st or anything like it.
It's the Lord's marvelous work and a wonder that he's bringing forth. So Joseph Smith's an important player, but without the God who's behind him, of course, he can't read a stitch of Reformed Egyptian. So it's the gift and power of God that brings forth the Book of Mormon. I'm a believer in the Book of Mormon in my bone marrow. I can't escape it. The book exists, and there's no getting around it. And of course, there's all kinds of explanations for it. He plagiarizes this, he plagiarizes that. He wrote it in a few months while he was spinning stories for his family about ancient Americans. But the fact of the matter remains for me, nobody's ever done anything like this before. This is remarkable. There's just 1 year, just the 18th year of the reign of the judges, has about 50 pages worth of Book of Mormon text on it. And just those 50 pages are so incredibly complicated that I can't imagine. They don't match anything like Joseph Smith ever wrote before or after. They're completely different. His 1832 autobiography, so 2.5 years or so after the Book of Mormon is published, Joseph writes in his own hand an autobiography, which is comparatively, literarily, very, very simple, very unsophisticated compared to the Book of Mormon. So I can't imagine that he produces that book out of his own head. It's unfathomable to me. To me, it's more impossible to believe that the Book of Mormon isn't what it claims to be than that it is what it claims to be. And I know there are people who feel just the opposite about that, but I can't imagine bringing myself to think about the Book of Mormon as other than what lots of witnesses, including Joseph Smith himself, said it is.
Joseph Smith could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter, let alone dictating a book like the Book of Mormon. And though I was an active participant in the scenes that transpired and was present during the translation of the plates, it is marvelous to me, a marvel and a wonder, as much so as to anyone else. Emma Smith.
Another thing that causes people to marvel about the Book of Mormon is the complexity of the text coupled with the amount of time in which it was produced.
Probably the best calculations we have are that by the end of June, so this would have been from April 7th to the end of June, maybe a total of, approaching 90 days total, but then when you understand that Joseph is still having to work a farm and keep things going that way, probably closer to 60 days of actual work days, where they were able to translate essentially what we have as the Book of Mormon today, translate it and write it and read it back and make sure that it's correct. To do that in that amount of time, hour after hour after hour, pretty much all available time. But it goes well, very well.
During that period, from April 7th until the end of June 1829, this like under 3 month period, Joseph Smith translated the 588 pages that appear in the 1830 Book of Mormon. In that very short period of time, he produced all of the text in our known Book of Mormon. This is an amazing feat. I think if you ask someone who's doing classics and they do their PhD and it takes them 10 years to master an ancient language and translate a single text for their book of their PhD, and ask them, how in the world could Joseph produce this text, this translated text, in under 3 months? There would have to be some sort of miraculous description of what happened.
Sometime near the end of June 1829, Joseph learned from the record that there would be three called to bear witness of the Book of Mormon record. That is our story when we return. I'm Glenn Rawson, and we'll see you then. Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on what you have listened to, please go to historyofthesaints.org. The History of the Saints team that produced this podcast has also produced numerous books and full-length documentaries on early Latter-day Saint church history and the key figures that made that history. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of History of the Saints has been produced by Dennis Lyman and Glenn Rawson. History of the Saints is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.